Welcome back to another episode of You Had to Be There. Today, we're turning back time to the turn of the century to talk about one of the most historically chaotic music festivals of all time, Woodstock 99. What started off as a powerful 60s movement of peace, love, and music for Woodstock turned into a fiery, toxic waste site decades later that was filled with violence, rage, and some of the biggest bands of 1999. Buckle up, because this is a true "you had to be there" kind of a story. And before we continue, I do want to give a fair trigger warning that this episode contains depictions of violence and sexual assault that some people may find disturbing. That being said, I do want to shout out some incredible resources and organizations that are available to those who have experienced sexual violence of any kind at shows and festivals. CallingAllCrows.org is one of my personal favorites, as well as, of course, the National Sexual Assault Hotline, which you can reach at 1-800-656-HOPE. Thanks so much, and let's get started. Let's take a few steps even further back in time, because it wouldn't be right to talk about Woodstock 99 unless we cover the OG Woodstock of 1969. As you probably already know, Woodstock became a symbol of the counterculture movement, a time for people to express themselves and celebrate music. It was truly a defining event for the baby boomer generation. Woodstock Music and Art Fair, commonly referred to as Woodstock, was held from August 15th to 18th, 1969, on a dairy farm in Bethel, New York. Woodstock was initiated through the efforts of a few different people. Michael Lang was one of them, and he went on to continue the legacy of Woodstock with a reprisal in 1994, 1999, and an attempt for a 50-year anniversary festival that was consequently canceled in 2019, which we'll get to later on. Tickets for the three-day festival in 1969, though, cost $18 in advance and $24 at the gate. That's equivalent to about $150 and $200 today. Crazy inflation. The underlying theme of this episode, in my opinion, is how crazy inflation continues to be, but we'll get more to that later on. Before Ticketmaster, waiting room queues, and overpriced resellers, tickets for Woodstock were limited to record stores in the greater New York City area or by mail at a specific mailbox station in Midtown Manhattan next to Radio City Music Hall. Around 186,000 advance tickets were sold. The organizers had anticipated approximately 50,000 festival goers would turn up for the three-day music concert, but instead it pulled an estimated 500,000 attendees. Overnight, the first day, 50,000 early birds had arrived and had planted themselves in front of the half-finished stage. For the rest of the weekend, concertgoers simply walked into the site with or without tickets. With no social media existing yet, radio and television stations were obviously very important, and their descriptions of the traffic jams discouraged people from setting off to the festival. Sullivan County even declared a state of emergency. Woodstock was supposed to be a profit-making venture, but it quickly became a free concert when circumstances prevented the organizers from installing fences and ticket booths before opening day. Promoters took heavy losses and only recovered their investment over the next 10 years through the sales of the documentary Woodstock soundtrack and merchandise and ticket sales, so there's that. The Woodstock documentary that came out in 1970 even received the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. Woodstock attendee Nancy Einstein recounts that the crowd was shoulder to shoulder as far as we could see. I couldn't tell how many people were there, but I'd never seen anything like it. If you moved your leg, an arm would take its place and the spot was gone. She also said a trip to the porta potties would take at least an hour each way, so one person would stay back and lay across the sleeping bags to save the spot. With no cell phones, you were basically screwed if you lost your friends. Given the insane number of attendees and the lack of preparation for such, it's impressive how the three-day festival avoided turning into an apocalyptic disaster. But just like any festival, there were still plenty of issues and tragedies, including three recorded fatalities, two drug overdoses, and an accident that involved someone getting run over by a tractor. Needless to say, it was becoming quite apparent that the facilities were not equipped to provide first aid or sanitation for the number of people attending. So hundreds of thousands of people found themselves up against bad weather, food shortages, and poor sanitation. And I'm probably stating the obvious, but drugs were about as prominent as there were bans. Over the course of the 3 days, there were 742 drug overdoses, according to an article from Time magazine. Einstein recounts that due to dwindling resources, quote, "They did airdrop in tons of sandwiches at one point, but I don't remember being very hungry. I was smoking a lot of dope, so I should have been very hungry." The New York Times even ran an editorial titled "Nightmare in the Catskills," which read in part, quote, "The dreams of marijuana and rock music that drew 300,000 fans and hippies to the Catskills." But coverage quickly actually became more positive by the end of the festival, partially due to parents of concertgoers calling the media and telling them that based on their children's phone calls, their reports were misleading. Imagine if TikTok was a thing back in 69 and how differently the media would have covered the festival, for better or for worse. 32 acts performed over the course of the 4 days, which I'm sure you know at least a few. Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Grateful Dead, The Who, Jefferson Airplane, Santana. Those are definitely worth mentioning. What's also worth mentioning are the missing acts who were invited, who didn't perform, including The Beatles, The Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, Simon and Garfunkel, all mostly due to scheduling conflicts. I wonder if they regret that decision. Despite the rain, mud, and drugs, Woodstock remains to be known as a historical moment in music history. Rolling Stone magazine listed it as number 19 of the 50 moments that changed the history of rock and roll. It's not too surprising that organizer Michael Lang wanted to commemorate the festival with the 25th anniversary, aka Woodstock 94. Lang partnered with New Jersey concert promoter John Schur, and they quickly got to work. This time, though, the festival took place on Winston Farm, just west of Saugerties, New York. Woodstock 94 has also been referred to as Mudstock or Mudstock 94 due to the rainy weather that resulted in mud pits. 164,000 tickets were sold, but the crowd at Woodstock 94 was estimated at 350,000. The size of the crowd was obviously a lot larger than concert organizers had planned for, shocker, and by the second night, many of the event policies were logistically unenforceable. Security lost control of monitoring the increasing number of people entering and exiting while at the same time maintaining safety, security, and a peaceful atmosphere. Due to the political climate and the trends of mainstream music, the weekend remained about as peaceful as it was muddy. Performers included Red Hot Chili Peppers, Aerosmith, Peter Gabriel, Green Day, The Cranberries, Sheryl Crow, and Metallica. Plus a ton of original performers from the 69 Woodstock made their reprisal, including Joe Cocker, the surviving members of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Bob Weir of The Grateful Dead, and many others. But it was Nine Inch Nails who had the largest crowd density at the whole event, overshadowing many of the other performers. So yeah, nothing too crazy, or at least crazy enough to discourage the organizers from wanting to try for another round, bringing us to the infamous Woodstock 99. I hope you have your baggy pants, beer cans, and body piercings ready for this roller coaster of a story. The San Francisco Chronicle simply called this festival, quote, "The Day the Music Died," alluding to the day the music died, which Don McLean sang about in American Pie. Others described it as being in another country during a military conflict. So Woodstock 99 was held from July 22nd to July 25th, 1999, in Rome, New York. It stayed in theme with being in an upstate New York town, but this time the festival site was the former Griffiths Air Force Base, roughly 100 miles northwest of the 1969 site in Bethel. A Rolling Stone reporter described it as, quote, "the least rock and roll venue imaginable, full of concrete and airplane hangars and barbed wire." Great choice. After Woodstock 94, it was the second largest scale music festival that attempted to emulate the original 69 Woodstock Festival. Approximately 400,000 people attended the festival over the 4 days. Promoters Michael Lang and John Schur partnered up again to bring, quote, the spirit of peace, music, and love to a new generation. But instead, it devolved into 3 days of scorching heat, raw sewage, misogyny, and greed in upstate New York. All the things you need for a perfect music festival. This decision was considered a risky proposition after dubbed Mudstock 94 led to such a large financial loss and negative press coverage. So let's talk about that venue choice of theirs. So the festival was held at the former Griffiths Air Force Base, a designated Superfund waste cleanup site, and during this time, the base was largely unused and in really poor condition. It had a huge lot of asphalt and unkept grass, and the two main stages were nearly 2 miles apart, perfect for the July heat. In fact, New York was experiencing an extreme heat wave that weekend. Temperatures reached up to 102 degrees Fahrenheit. That felt like 104, so slightly hotter than the heat wave the East Coast faced last summer in 2023. In the HBO documentary Woodstock 99, Peace, Love, and Rage, which I will be frequently referencing in the rest of this episode, they interviewed veteran performers, The Offspring, in which the lead singer recalls playing a festival ground in Germany around the same time that was, quote, literally built by Hitler to be more hospitable than the airbase. And to avoid gate crashing that occurred during the previous years, Lang and Scher decided to install a 12-foot wall of plywood and steel. Lang dubbed it as the Peace Wall and invited numerous volunteers to paint on sections of the panel, because nothing says peace like a 12-foot wall, right? As for security, to avoid, quote, the influences of the government or of the state police, according to Lang, organizers did not hire conventional security officers. Instead, they sourced adolescents and young adults from a near job agency to serve as what they called the Peace Patrol. This was about as much of a joke as it sounds. Nearly all of the Peace Patrol officers lacked any prior experience in security or law enforcement, and they were unarmed and most just seemed completely uninterested in performing their duties. Many of the security simply sold their spare security shirts to other concertgoers or abandoned their posts entirely. Some Peace Patrol guards alleged that others had taken way too much advantage of their power, and they even demanded sexual favors from women in the audience. Lovely. Woodstock 99 was to be executed as a commercial venture with dozens of corporate sponsors. They even had an email station and ATMs conveniently located in certain areas of the festival. It's also important to note that during a time when MTV ruled the younger generation, they covered the festival extensively with live coverage available on pay-per-view, so you can really see firsthand the horrors of what was about to unfold. Advance tickets for the event were priced at $150, so that's equivalent to like $277 today, plus service charges. Tickets purchased at the gate cost $180. At the time, this was considered very costly for a festival of this kind. Less than 200,000 tickets were actually sold, but as a reminder, 400,000 people or more attended the festival over the 4 days. So much for the peace wall. So back on the topic of inflation and overcharging at festivals and shows, we see this problem at venues today constantly. Like how I mentioned in my previous episode about Avant Gardner, they charge about $19 plus tip for vodka Red Bulls. But even before the turn of the new millennium, overpriced concessions was a huge issue for festival attendees. Numerous budget cuts were made during the hiring process for concession vendors at Woodstock 99, so organizers were forced to lease services from numerous subcontractors whose contracts gave them complete control of pricing. Corporate greed. The festival charged $4 for a bottle of water, which is the equivalent of about $7 today, and between $8 to $10 for a slice of pizza, a sandwich, or a burrito, which comes to almost $20 today, at an event that prohibited people from bringing in outside food and drinks. Even worse, supplies of food and water dwindled over the 3 days of the festival, which vendors took full advantage of and raised their prices. So by the third day of the festival, booths charged up to $12, equivalent to $22 today, for water bottles. Performers were appalled by the prices of concessions, too. Kid Rock and Wyclef Jean asked the audience to throw their empty water bottles on stage in between songs. Insane Clown Posse taped $100 bills to several beach balls and kicked them into the crowd during their performance, resulting in members of the audience fighting over the money. There were free fountain water stations that were meant for people to drink, shower, brush their teeth, but unfortunately, those quickly became unusable. Feces from latrines contaminated the water. Plus, the groundwater and soil at the site had been contaminated by heavy metals and toxic chemicals from its time as a military installation. Understandably, people were getting tired of long lines for water. People started to tear up the underground water systems and began jumping into the mud pits and water puddles to stay cool in the intense heat, unaware of the contamination. The county health department analyzed a sample of the free drinking water and they found it to be contaminated with E. coli and other bacteria. Disgusting is an understatement. Even grosser, the number of porta potties installed proved insufficient for the number of attendees. The toilets and showers soon became unusable and overflowing, and men resorted to urinating on the sides of the toilets or behind the vendor stalls. In the documentary, an attendee claimed that he would use pizza boxes to sleep on because you could, quote, tell if they were yellow and could be deemed as safe. Subcontracted sanitation workers often failed to appear for their duties, allowing all the trash to pile up throughout the site, too. Clearly, this was already a hot mess, but let's not forget it was a music festival, after all. So let's talk about the lineup and the rise of nu metal at the time this festival was put on. Let's just say that the lineup did not help improve the mood. Hard rock and nu metal bands dominated the lineup. If you're unfamiliar with nu metal, it's a style that mixed hard rock and hip-hop, also known as frat rock, that briefly took young white Americans by storm. These bands on the lineup included Korn, Insane Clown Posse, Kid Rock, and Limp Bizkit, the big stars of the 90s. One journalist shared that, quote, the festival felt like it was for angry white dudes by angry white dudes. A lot of attendees, though, did feel like it was hypocritical for MTV to promote the festival's heavier rock acts while also featuring boy bands like Backstreet Boys on their television and radio programming. And this included one of the lineup bands, The Offspring, who during their performance set up inflatables of each of the Backstreet Boys and bashed their balloon heads with a baseball bat. In its defense, nu metal's most popular acts would consistently top sales charts at that time, and they'd sell out arenas worldwide and even compete up against acts like Britney Spears for music video airplay on MTV's popular show at the time, TRL. Woodstock 99 performer and award-winning producer Moby is interviewed in the documentary, and at one point he says, it sounds simple, I know, but if you want to know why nu metal became such a thing, it was purely commercial. The industry realized they could make more money by marketing to a larger demographic. Even Jonathan Davis, the lead singer of one of the most popular nu metal bands at the time, Korn, said that the nu metal scene at the time was, quote, full of misogynistic, opportunistic, dickhead jocks, the kind of people who'd be bullying me at school if they weren't supporting my band at shows. And while nu metal dominated the three-day lineup, women of the 90s music scene did not. In fact, the festival only booked three female acts for the whole weekend, one for each day: Alanis Morissette, Jewel, and Sheryl Crow. The dominance of angry white men and teens set the tone for misogyny and racism on the festival grounds of the moment it opened. Because after a decade of Girls Gone Wild setting the tone that women are meant to be sex objects for men, the festival just felt completely oversaturated with frontal female nudity and misogyny. Even the cameramen were eating it up and provoking women to show and flash their tits at the cameras, making it a complete distraction from what people were actually there for, the music. Even during the Offspring set, Dexter Holland, the frontman, had to ask the cameraman to move his camera and actually face the stage. He was literally like, hey man, like, the fucking music's up here. Another iconic thing that he did during their set. He, in the documentary, you can literally see, he says, just because a girl wants to go crowd surfing, it doesn't give the guys the right to molest them. Holland later told victims of sexual assault in the crowd to confront the perpetrators and, quote, grab their fucking balls. Sometimes what needs to be said needs to be said. But of course, the majority of the male performers encouraged misogyny as well. Like Kid Rock, who during his set decided to address the Clinton scandal and said, Monica Lewinsky is a hoe and Bill Clinton is a goddamn pimp. Nice. When men started to harass Sheryl Crow during her performance, chanting, show us your tits, she responded with the iconic line, you'd have to pay a whole lot more than you paid to get in to see my tits. She recalls the performance as being, quote, the worst gig she ever had, back in an interview in 2019. Alanis Morissette remembers it being really, really tense during her set because a majority of fans that were in attendance were waiting for Limp Bizkit's performance, so some began booing and chanting Limp Bizkit during the end of her set as they continued to get more and more impatient. There were several sexual assaults reported throughout the festival, but it's widely believed that a far greater number of unreported incidents occurred. Specifically, numerous fans reported witnessing further incidents of sexual assault during both Limp Bizkit's and Metallica's performances. Attendee Ethan Fixell from an article recalls, you couldn't go more than 5 minutes without seeing a topless woman being fondled by a random stranger. After the conclusion of the festival, members of the National Organization for Women gathered outside the New York offices of one of the promoters to protest the sexual violence against women which had occurred. They even created an anonymous forum online for women to recount their assault stories after the festival. Some of them were as young as 14 years old. Many of them sadly included mentions of their assaults, quote, being their fault. This is still a major problem today at concerts. A recent study a few years ago in 2017 revealed that 30% of women have experienced some sort of unwanted sexual behavior while at a concert or festival. 41% of women have experienced two or three forms of unwanted sexual behavior, and 18% have experienced four or more. Obviously, this should go without saying, but women deserve and belong at concerts just as much as men do, and it should be a safe experience for everyone. In terms of racism, DMX performed his song My N-Word and encouraged the thousands of predominantly white audience members to chant the song along with him. Some niggas that you don't want to try, some niggas just really do or die, but have your cowards ready to cry, for fraud, for fraud, keep niggas on their fucking job, so what is like this shit getting hard, they're pulling you up in niggas' cars, God. It really makes me wonder how this left the few people of color in the audience and watching at home feeling. We still have a lot to unpack, so the best way to uncover the full 3 days of chaos is to take you through Friday to Sunday. So let's start with day one on Friday. On day one, despite the anticipation for peace, love, and good vibes, dozens of security workers hired to work the event already ended up quitting or getting fired. Even though concertgoers were told that they'd be searched at the gates, it was only a matter of time before fields of empty beer bottles and the strong scent of weed wafted across the grounds. In the documentary, you see one attendee bragging that he paid off a security guard for all of the confiscated beer that they took from people entering the festival. Another man was caught carrying $16,000 in cash and ended up arrested Saturday night in the campground for selling mushrooms, according to a state trooper. According to a reporter on the scene, they said, everyone was aggressive and they were quite willing to push the limits of an atmosphere of freedom and impunity and had little tolerance for the discomfort that they experienced. Medical personnel were already dealing with dozens of heat-related illnesses on day one as the heat reached 90 degrees. Even Korn's frontman, Jonathan Davis, ended up collapsing after their last song of their set and had to be given IVs and oxygen immediately as he got off stage. In the MTV coverage that you see in the documentary, although you can tell like how quite large these crowds were for bands, you really just can't conceptualize how insane it would be to have been one of those people among the thousands and thousands of fans. Crowds were so large that the sound from the monitors traveled in waves, and performers said they could literally see the fluctuation of sound traveling from the stage throughout the hundreds of people row by row. While surprisingly nothing was bad enough to disrupt the performances, Bush frontman Gavin Rossdale had reportedly expressed anxiety about playing immediately after Korn set due to fears that the crowd's energy could, quote, turn violent. Well, he was right, because day two, Saturday, the temperatures continued to rise, leaving attendees desperately ripping faucets off the temporary water lines to stir up some mud to wallow in and to create impromptu fountains to beat the relentless heat. I definitely traumatized you enough describing all of the plumbing or lack thereof issues, so we'll move on. Even worse, the heat wave was exacerbated by heat radiating off the former airbase's black tarmac. As the temperature got worse, resources started dwindling and people's patience started rapidly declining too. The turning point definitely came during the Limp Bizkit set on Saturday night. The band's lead singer, Fred Durst, gave a frenetic performance, encouraging his audience to give in to their rage and, quote, break everything, to not resign themselves to the conformist shit that people like Alanis Morissette want to sell you.
How many people here ever woke up one morning and just decided it wasn't one of those days and you're gonna break some shit? This is one of them days, yo, where everything's fucked up. You just want to break some shit. You feel me? Let's feel it. It's just one of those days when you don't want to wake up. Everything is fucked. Everybody sucks. You don't really know why.
The thousands upon thousands of new metal fans did exactly that. People stormed and even smashed a sound control tower.
Motherfucker, it's just one of those days!
Confronted with their involvement in the violent responses from the audience, lead singer Fred Durst gave an interview that was as brief as it was revealing. All he said was, "It's not our fault." Festival attendee Ethan Fixell was only 17 years old when he found himself within the chaos of the Limp Bizkit set. He recalls, quote, "It was ugly, and I remember feeling, for the first time at a rock show, unsafe. As if anything could happen to me, and no one, not my friends, or even the police, could help." In the documentary, you can see the stage's view of the thousands of mosh pits and crowd surfers and chaos, and I don't disagree with Fred Durst that it wasn't the band's fault. They're performers, not police officers, but it's quite apparent to any witness that they encouraged what was happening during their new metal craze set. And to make matters worse, the promoters thought that a rave tent would be a nice addition to the festival, so that night at 2 a.m., a van suddenly drove onto the dance floor, forcing DJ and producer Fatboy Slim to abruptly stop his performance. And when security personnel gained control of the vehicle, they discovered a drugged teenage girl inside who exhibited obvious signs of having been sexually assaulted. Late Saturday evening, a lot of people decided that they had enough and made the right decision to end their three-day experience a day short. The general crowd consensus was, "I need a shower, and besides, I'm out of money." With barely any water and clean resources available, there wasn't much keeping them interested enough to take on day three. State police said that by late afternoon, more than 70,000 people had departed the grounds. For the other morons, kidding, sort of, though, they were ready to take on the challenge of a third day with more heat, more bands, and even more chaos. Late Sunday afternoon, local officials conducted a press conference praising the planning and effort of the weekend. It seemed like promoters Lang and Cher did not want to take any accountability for the past 2 days, except for the positive praise. They said, quote, "We're having fun. We had worked a year to plan this, and it was working. Yes, issues exist, but they are isolated. Nobody came here thinking they were going to stay at the Ritz-Carlton." When asked about the rowdy crowds, their response could not have been more understated in terms of the magnitude of the chaos that continued to unfold. They said, quote, "We have some amazing music, then you got knuckleheads, maybe 50 of them causing trouble, so let's try to focus on the overwhelming positiveness." Well, spoiler alert, unfortunately they ended up eating their words. The overwhelming positiveness quickly dwindled into a fiery blaze of turmoil. it didn't take long for Sunday to feel tense. In the documentary, performer Jewel recalled a feeling of dread during her performance due to the audience's tension and bitterness. She described them as really tired and very depleted, so she immediately returned to her tour bus after her set with her team and fled the site. Numerous witnesses recalled noticing more and more fights and property damage occurring across the festival grounds on that Sunday, including objects being thrown at performers and security having to step in a lot more. Just like in an action movie produced in Hollywood, in the documentary, we start to see some foreshadowing of an action-packed climax. A cameraman innocently interviews an enthusiastic festival attendee and activist who was explaining a brilliant idea, quote, that was approved by Michael Lang himself, according to several sources. Led by the anti-gun violence organization PAX, they had an innocent enough idea to distribute candles to those stopping at their booth during the day so that they could be lit for a candlelight vigil for the victims of the Columbine High School massacre during the closing set from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. This was a very bad idea, needless to say, and at the time, this hadn't even been approved or mentioned to local firefighting authorities. So later that night, with the remaining thousands of people there, once the Chili Peppers took the stage, it was only a matter of time before attendees began to feel the heat, literally and figuratively. As planned by PAX, the crowd began to light the candles during the Chili Peppers set, but some quickly decided to use them to start massive bonfires. And to add insult to injury, the band decided to perform Jimi Hendrix's Fire as the band's encore. A quite unfortunate choice, although I did read that in Anthony Kiedis, the Chili Peppers frontman's biography, he had apparently promised a family member of Hendrix that they'd pay tribute at the end of their set. Still though, that song choice seemed a little bit too intentional just to be a coincidence. So after the Red Hot Chili Peppers finished their main set, the audience was informed about a, quote, bit of a problem by an announcer on stage. An audio tower had caught fire. Shortly after the tower began burning, a large group of concertgoers climbed the base of its scaffolding, and the tower then collapsed onto the field. The local fire department was called in finally to extinguish it, though they refused the call. It's really wild because in the documentary, you actually see all of this play out, just like I said, like an action movie climax. They even interviewed the former mayor of Rome in the documentary, and he recalled pleading with the Chili Peppers to return to the stage and calm down the crowd in the midst of all of the chaos. When Anthony Kiedis stepped back on stage and saw all the fires, he just said, "Holy shit, it's a apocalypse now out there." Really helpful. The fires continued to spread out of control, obviously, and so did the anger of attendees. Angered crowds turned into aggressive riots who were looking for any excuse to get feral. And even funnier, prior to the start of the performances that day, there were a bunch of rumors that, like, a possible unannounced performance was going to happen after the Red Hot Chili Peppers. There were rumors that it was going to be Prince, the Rolling Stones, Bruce Springsteen. It was just like a big rumor mill of who the secret closing act would be. Hilariously enough, the finale was revealed to be a laser show and footage of Jimi Hendrix performing at the original Woodstock in 69. So of course that pissed off an already angered crowd and just added insult to injury, making people riot even harder. Things got crazy. ATMs were tipped over and broken into. Trailers were full of merchandise, food, and equipment started getting forced open and burglarized. Abandoned vendor booths and tents were turned over and just completely set on fire. Approximately $22,000 in total was robbed from ATMs just from people prying them open with their bare hands. People started to even rip off plywood from the peace wall surrounding the festival grounds and using it to set things ablaze. MTV even ultimately evacuated its entire crew during the violence on Sunday night. Longtime anchor Kurt Loder compared the experience to covering news in a war zone as concert goers began violently attacking the news trucks and reporters. MTV host Carson Daly recalls being pelted by bottles, rocks, batteries all throughout his weekend just covering the festival. Festival savages gathered in groups throughout the site next to their blazing bonfires and pounded on metal cans together in strange tribal beats as people were screaming and yelling with semi-trailers exploding right behind them. Needless to say, things continued to escalate and spiral out of control. By 11:45 p.m. that night, the chaos had finally attracted the attention of nearby law enforcement. A large force of 500 to 700 New York State police troopers, local police officers, and various other law enforcement arrived at the scene. A little late there. Most had on riot control gear and proceeded to form a riot line that flushed the crowd to the northwest, which was like away from the stage located at the eastern end of the airfield. Some claim that the riot line allowed the concertgoers to basically just tire themselves out in the campground area, and it wasn't until well after sunrise that the fires were contained. Overall, it seemed that the escalation of the riots resulted in having a white privilege tone. Since the rioters were primarily young white men, authorities remained nonviolent and unprovoked. One of the journalists interviewed in the documentary makes a very compelling point that if this had happened at a hip-hop festival in the 2010s, the outcome would have looked very different. Reports suggest that about 44 people were arrested over the course of the festival. 10 state troopers and 2 state police supervisors were also reportedly demoted or suspended for their poor behavior at the festival. In terms of Woodstock 99's aftermath, promoter John Schur doesn't seem to have any regrets regarding the festival except one. He wishes he hadn't booked so many hard rock acts on that Saturday, the night with Limp Bizkit, Metallica, and Rage Against the Machine. Actually, it's the night that most people mistakenly believe was the night of the riots, so I don't really see how that's relevant, but I guess it, in his defense, it was creating a lot of tension leading up to the Sunday riots. But honestly, in my opinion, it wouldn't have killed them to book more female acts too, but I digress. Schur and Lang's hope of making millions from the festival, aided by a soundtrack album and film, had literally gone up in smoke. The media quickly began to portray them as greedy money grabbers who created an environment that endangered so much violence. It's tragic, but also hard to believe that there were only 3 fatalities over the course of the entire weekend. The post-festival cleanup of the site took a full 3 weeks. After numerous lawsuits and fines resulting from the incidents occurring throughout the event, the city of Rome only profited $200,000 from the entire weekend. Interestingly, less than a week after the conclusion of Woodstock 99, Los Angeles concert promoters Golden Voice announced the inaugural Coachella Festival in Indio, California. As an attempt to distance themselves from the damage that unfolded in Rome, they offered free water bottles and parking for those in attendance. Gotta love the direct shade. And it goes without saying that even today, Coachella is one of the biggest music festivals in the world. In more recent years, a hopeful 50th anniversary Woodstock was in the works by Lang and Schur and was planned for August 2019 in upstate New York, with featured artists like Jay-Z, The Killers, Dead & Company, Miley Cyrus, and more that ended up never seeing the light of day. Financial backers basically continued to pull out, leading to the eventual cancellation of the event. Sadly, Michael Lang died in 2021 due to complications from a rare form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Schur kept on being a big-time concert promoter after the festival. In fact, in the year 2000, so the year after Woodstock 99, the live music trade publication Pollstar named him Promoter of the Year. That's how quickly the industry ended up moving on from Woodstock 99. It's quite difficult to summarize the experience of the whole festival, but I think that festival attendee Ethan Fixell said it best. Quote, "If anything, Woodstock taught me that nothing in this world is black and white. The capacity for both love and greed exists to some degree in all of us. The highest highs can come with the lowest lows. Beauty can be corrupted. But mention Woodstock 99 to me, and my initial feelings aren't of guilt or disgust. They're of joy, nostalgia, and the thrill of being able to utter the phrase, 'Dude, I was there.'" Thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of You Had to Be There. Also, be sure to check out the official You Had to Be There Instagram at You Had to Be There Pod to see some scenes of the crime photographs from firsthand attendees. Until then, see you next time.